I don't know how many people, and maybe not my team, we'll see, could do the run I just did. That's a bold move with little rest.
As the Iditarod hits the Yukon, the frontrunners shake things up. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, March 11th. Good evening, I'm Rachel Waldholtz. Also tonight, 20% of Haines residents are over 65. Is that good or bad?
It's underrated the amount of impact retirees and an aging population can bring to a community.
That story is part of our Aging Southeast series and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Full Circle, delivering organic produce and groceries across Alaska since 2006, featuring fresh pasta, coffee, fish, and baked items from Alaskan producers. More at fullcircle.com/APRN. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future that delivers oil today and sustains operations for tomorrow.
Allie Zirkel was the first musher to reach the Yukon River checkpoint of Galena this morning. Brent Sass was next into the checkpoint, but moved through without stopping. He's closing in on Nulato, according to the Iditarod GPS tracker. Mushers must take an 8-hour rest in one of the Yukon River checkpoints of Ruby, Galena, Nulato, or Caltag. Teams were moving down the Yukon River all afternoon. Many came off an 8-hour rest, but some mushers chose to push their teams before taking the mandatory break. KNOM's Emily Schwing reports.
It was just before noon as Brent Sass's dog team sped through the Galena checkpoint.
And what's your plan?
I'm going through.
Okay.
So I just need to get into my bags real quick.
All right, we need drop bags. Straw.
I don't need any straw, I just need my drop bags.
Sass also didn't take any extra dog food with him, which means he probably didn't plan to camp on his way to Nulato. But he did take some human food, a bag of chocolate chip cookies, another bag of candy, and a few small bits of gear. The thick layer of clouds that blanketed the town all morning was just burning off as Sass scrambled through Galena. Overnight, the weather system dropped a couple inches of fresh snow on the river.
Yeah, it was fine. Padding for the dogs.
And his dogs, said Sass, were doing great.
Oh, they're wonderful. They're eating like crazy. I got no complaints. I got 14 strong, pulling dogs. So, I'm a happy man at the moment. Okay, let's go.
As Sass sped past, Allie Zirkel's dogs barely lifted their heads. They arrived an hour earlier and were now snuggled in for their mandatory 8-hour rest, after a long, hard push from Takotna.
I don't know how many people, and maybe not my team, we'll see, could do the run I just did. That's a bold move with little rest.
After Zirkel's team left Takotna, they only rested 6 hours in a day and a half long push to Galena.
Well, you only know what you do kind of after. We'll see if I'm picking up the pieces or not.
Zirkel says this was her big move. A reroute due to open water on the river means what's traditionally a 37-mile run to Nulato has now been extended by roughly 20 miles overland. But she says her effort might have given her an advantage.
We'll see what they look like. I mean, an 8-hour rest is a long rest. And then it's interesting, it's now a 58 instead of a short little run. That kind of throws a hole. Actually, that's in my favor because I'm sitting here 8. And I kind of think I'm going to just skip through the checkpoints now. I kind of don't want to do another long run because I don't want to take all their speed away.
As Zirkel pondered her next step in the mid-afternoon, mushers who opted to take their 8-hour layovers earlier in the morning in Ruby were just starting to hit the trail again. Pete Kaiser says a tough run gave him a reason to stop.
Rough trail and long miles both, yeah.
But perhaps his stop in Ruby had more to do with how tired he was.
I smashed my nose on my handlebar 3 times this morning. Falling asleep felt good.
Kaiser wasn't the only sleepy musher. Michelle Phillips also says she stopped because her dogs needed rest, but she seemed pretty trail-worn herself.
It's changing so much, right? Like, it used to be a good trail with something different than it is now. The trail now is a little bit of snow that you travel on, bouncing along, crashing into things.
She also opted to take 8 hours because it would put her on a better schedule. But some mushers weren't quite ready to stay.
Dogs are doing good. Figure I can save it for a little bit.
Your Lifeseth Olsom stomped for only 4 hours, long enough to get a meal into his dogs.
Making some dog food for him.
Oh, what's in the dog food?
Oh, I got a couple different types of meat, two types of fat.
He says he's been holding his team back, but with river miles ahead, it's time to let up on the break.
Now, I'm just gonna try and follow my plan and see how the team looks. Yeah. Still gotta go up the whole Yukon River, so maybe if you got some juice in Kaltai, we can do something.
Is that what you're shooting for, juice in Kaltai?
That'd be nice. But it's a lot of nice dog teams, that's for sure.
As teams wind their way down the Yukon, mushers will start to find out how the rest they've built up in the first half of the race translates to speed. Reporting from the Iditarod Trail, I'm Emily Schwing on the Yukon River.
For much more on the Iditarod, visit our website, alaskapublic.org. Our Mushing Explained video series takes a look at what mushers pack with them along the trail. Alaska Native leaders held a press call yesterday urging Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan to give a fair hearing and timely vote to President Barack Obama's forthcoming Supreme Court nomination. KBBI's Daisha Eaton reports.
The seat was left vacant when Justice Antonin Scalia died in February. Jacqueline Peta, executive director of the National Congress of American Indians, says leaving the seat empty could harm Native people.
Tribes are affected by the federal courts to a greater degree than almost any other group in the country. So it would not be good for Native people and our tribal governments if the Supreme Court is caught in a 4-4 tie for the next 2 years.
Peta pointed out that the court regularly hears cases involving subsistence on federal public lands, protection of children under the Indian Child Welfare Act, and tribal programs under the Indian Self-Determination Act. She said important legal questions could be held in limbo if the seat is left unfilled. Julie Kitka, president of Alaska Federation of Natives, says filling the vacancy on the high court is critical.
We must recognize that the U.S. Supreme Court is a highly specialized institution with a unique set of procedures that include complete discretion on whether or not it'll hear a case or not, with a much keener focus on policy considerations than other federal courts.
Both Peta and Kitka discouraged Alaska's delegation from joining in the obstructionist rhetoric of GOP leaders who've said they may block the president's nomination. And they say they hope the president will consider nominating a Native American from the western United States who has a grounding in federal Indian law. They urged the nomination of Diane Hamitawa, a member of the Hopi tribe from Arizona. In Homer, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Governor Bill Walker is seeking to streamline three state agencies responsible for financing economic development, housing, and renewable energy. He signed an administrative order yesterday requiring the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, Alaska Energy Authority, and Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority to find opportunities to become more efficient or consolidate. The agencies have more than $3 billion in assets and employ 440 people. Walker says the state hasn't predetermined what the outcome will be.
This is a process that will be inclusive, not exclusive. It's not going to be a process that we come up with an edict on the third floor and say this is the way it's going to be. We invite them. No one knows their agency better than them. So they have been doing this a bit internally themselves, so we just have expanded that a bit.
Commissioner of Administration Sheldon Fisher will lead the effort. Walker says he expects the recommendations will require new state laws next legislative session. And a proposal to streamline voter registration with permanent fund dividend applications has secured a spot on the ballot this summer. Alaskans will weigh in on the PFD voter initiative during the August 16th state primary election. It will be the only measure on the ballot, according to the Division of Elections. Supporters of the measure say it would eliminate redundancies in government and make it easier for people to vote. But some opponents fear giving too much personal information to the state. The PFD voter initiative does include an opt-out clause. The Division of Elections estimates that some 70,000 more people will be registered if the initiative passes. A big life still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a big life change for a young couple we've been following in their recovery from addiction.
It's really hard. Like, even if somebody's trying or if somebody doesn't know, it's still really, it sucks. It just sucks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The state legislature may soon take control over which bodies of water in Alaska get the highest level of protection. That designation is called Tier 3, or Outstanding Natural Resource Waters. Governor Bill Walker says the consequences of Tier 3 status are too far-reaching for a state agency to have final say. KDLG's Dave Bendinger has more.
States are mandated by the EPA to create a process for how Tier 3 waters are designated. Right now, Governor Walker is suggesting the legislature take control of those designations rather than leave it to the Department of Environmental Conservation. There's a bill in the Senate now to do that, and DEC Commissioner Larry Hartig explained it a bit to the Senate Resources Committee on Monday.
The bill that we have in front of us, SB 163, does three things. Most importantly, it clarifies who has authority to designate a Tier 3 water in Alaska. Second, and related to the first, SB 163 makes a clear policy choice whether the legislature wants to have a say in the designation of a Tier 3 water. And lastly, the bill provides a process for the public to make nominations and a process, the legislative process itself, for acting on nominations.
Why does this matter? Because Tier 3 waters, once designated, are protected to the nation's highest standards, and there's no mechanism to change them, ever.
Basically, you cannot put any additional pollution into that water if it's Tier 3, even if that additional pollution would not affect any of the existing uses, including aquatic life use, drinking water use, recreation, or any other uses of that stream.
The criteria for Tier 3 waters is that they have to be outstanding in quality or purity and have exceptional recreation or ecological significance. Both the Coctulee River and the Bristol Bay watershed have been nominated in the past by groups hoping to block development like the Pebble Mine. Those are two of less than a handful of applications in the state of Alaska, which right now has no Tier 3 designated waters. Hartig pointed out that many, perhaps most of Alaska's waters could be eligible, which is in part why the executive branch thinks it should be the legislature's job to set policy here, in case there's room for compromise.
The legislature could determine that we do want to protect this water in some special way. It has special value, but we don't necessarily want to lock it up, if you will, for in perpetuity or potentially in perpetuity. So you carve out some other mechanism to protect it. For instance, designation of a state park or a game refuge, a fish refuge, whatever.
Senator Kathy Geisel chairs the Resources Committee. On Monday, she expressed part of her concern, which appeared to be shared by several other members, about designating any Tier 3 waters in Alaska.
We're still discovering new resources that we would want to develop, and I envision that it would be possible that we would have a resource upriver on a water body that had been designated Tier 3 that we now want to develop. And we can document that it would have minimal impact on the water quality, and we want to undeclare that water body from its Tier 3 designation.
DEC cautioned lawmakers that if the state of Alaska doesn't set its own policy, it runs the risk of being sued, and perhaps opening the door for the EPA to intervene and create that process itself. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
As senior populations grow throughout southeast Alaska, what kind of impact do they have on the economy? According to experts, it's a good one. A state report on Alaska's aging population says seniors contributed an estimated $2.4 billion to the economy in 2014. That comes mostly from retirement income, healthcare spending, and wages. As part of Coast Alaska's Aging Southeast series, KHNS's Emily Files brings us more from Haines.
Ron Jackson is 75 years old. He moved to Haines 15 years ago after retirement.
This was the closest thing to home that I'd ever felt, so that was pretty cool.
As Jackson puts it, in Haines, there's gray hair everywhere. 18% of residents are 65 or older. And seniors are on track to make up more than a third of the population by 2024. Haines also has the oldest median age in the state, 48.5. That's about 14 years above the state average and 9 years above the region. So how does the abundance of seniors in this 2,000-person town impact its economy? Here's state economist Connor Bell.
One thing is that retirement income works as an injection into the economy, where there are basically outside dollars that retirees are able to use on goods and services purchased locally. So it's money that wouldn't otherwise be circulating in the economy.
Jackson says older customers are especially important in communities like Haines, where the economy booms in the summer and busts in the winter.
Throughout that entire year, a senior income is stable. Generally, it's some annuity that's been earned or Social Security, and it survives the ups and downs of an economy. So it's almost a stabilizing influence on our local economy.
Economist Bell says another benefit that comes from a large senior population is increased demand for health care. Marnie Hartman, a doctor of physical therapy in Haines, says that's been her experience.
I would say probably 50 to 60% of my patient base, depending on the flow at that time, qualifies for Medicare, which means 65 and older.
Residents 65 and older have a positive economic impact by bringing in stable outside incomes and more healthcare spending. But what about the tax breaks they receive? Take, for example, the state-mandated senior property tax exemption. It tells municipalities not to charge property tax on the first $150,000 value of a home.
So if you had a $200,000 house, you were only paying on $50,000.
Kathy Wasserman is the executive director of the Alaska Municipal League. AML is fighting the tax exemption mandate. She says the state should reimburse local governments for the money lost on the exemption.
Municipalities need the freedom to be able to look at this policy within their own community and say, okay, this is our financial position at this time, or our financial environment, and we can afford this much, but we can't afford to exempt everybody.
State data shows that in fiscal year 2015, the exemption cost Southeast communities more than $5 million. In addition to that lost revenue, some municipalities have senior sales tax exemptions. Sitka, Petersburg, and Juneau leaders are among those who have considered doing away with the breaks. With a rapidly aging population, some say they're unsustainable. But all of those efforts were met with community backlash.
It's just disgusting that you keep picking on the old people.
That's Sitka resident Shirley Robards speaking to the Borough Assembly in 2015. The only one of those three Southeast towns that successfully scaled back senior tax breaks is Juneau. Economist Bell says things like tax exemptions lead some people to view an aging population as inherently bad for an economy, but he disagrees.
It's underrated the amount of impact retirees and an aging population can bring to a community.
Jackson, the 75-year-old retiree, says Haines seniors are involved.
The definition of a senior isn't an old person that sits around a lot and drains the system. They're out there hiking the trails and working on projects.
He says, aside from spending at local businesses, seniors volunteer and serve in government. And he's not alone in that view. Many in Haines say the same thing. Seniors here are active. They contribute to the community. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
It's as easy as 1, 2, 3. 1, file your 2016 PFD application today. 2, receive a confirmation of filing. And 3, sign electronically with your secure My Alaska account. Visit pfd.alaska.gov for more information. And remember, the deadline to apply is Thursday, March 31st. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka, Chugiak,
Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Quentin Chandler. This week on AK, moving forward. A year ago, we first heard from a young couple who were trying to overcome their addictions to methamphetamines. Their strategy was to move away from Anchorage and try to start over in Wasilla.
Okay, if you try to quit and you're still around all those people that do drugs and all the druggies, then...
it makes it 1,000 times harder. Mm-hmm.
They ended up back in Anchorage when they lost their housing, but despite their challenges, the couple is still sober. KSKA's Urban Affairs reporter Ann Hillman checked in for an update.
First thing you need to know. Originally, I called the couple Kylie and Madison. Kylie was a minor. I had to change both of their names. They hated it.
They were cool names, just not... No,
I didn't like my name.
You didn't? Your name wasn't that bad.
Right, Madison.
My name, yeah, okay.
So terrible choices. Yeah, sorry about that.
It's okay. I didn't email back fast enough.
But now, even though one is only 17 and the other is 20, they are married and are both legally adults. And they want you to know...
My name's Mason Ballison.
Hi, my name's Jasmine Ballison.
Mason is older, Jasmine is younger. At this point, they both say meth isn't a big issue anymore. They both drink a little, but say the cravings for the drug went away after about 5 months. They have a frequent reminder of its impacts as well. Jasmine's little brother was born with drugs in his system and is developmentally delayed. Both her dad and the baby's mother were using substances.
Makes me angry thinking that they had to put themselves first so much that there's now like a new life that is...
that's suffering.
His life is affected immediately and he has no choice.
But Mason and Jasmine do have a choice and they're focusing on their futures. For Mason, his future is in transition. He recently came out as transgender. He says it was a hard thing to admit, even to Jasmine. Their first conversation about it was over text.
Thank God for texting. Because it's just something that was really hard to say out loud.
Mason says he always knew in the back of his mind that he was born in the wrong body. He preferred boys' clothes, wanted short hair, and liked it when people thought he was a boy. But he saw a friend transition, and the backlash scared him.
People were, like, mean to him. Like, they would call him by his birth name and, like, just, like, a bunch of stuff. And I saw the things that he went through. Like, it was, like with his body, like, you know, because you feel like you're born in the wrong body, and so you hate your body. And you hate your voice.
Mason says he tried to deny to himself that he was also transgender. It made him depressed, and that might have contributed to his drug use. Now that he's out, he says he's happier, but it's still hard when someone uses the wrong pronoun.
Feels like a giant stab in the face. It's really hard. Like, even if somebody's trying, or if somebody doesn't know, it sucks, because it just sucks.
Jasmine says she's being as supportive as she can. She loves Mason, and she says it doesn't change their relationship. One of her main focuses right now is making sure they're financially stable. She's working part-time and looking for a second job. Her current employer can't give her full-time hours and promote her to co-manager until she turns 18 this summer. Jasmine says she likes being a legal adult and finally having control over her life.
Like, I went and signed up for, like, insurance for myself, my PFDs, and it's nice knowing that I don't have to rely on anybody else.
She's also trying to earn enough credits to graduate from high school because someday she wants to start her own interactive improv company.
I like theater because it makes people feel things from that. And I think being able to actually get up and do things with the actors is going to be something that not only people enjoy, but they're going to remember more than going and sitting in a dark theater watching a bunch of other people do something.
Mason says his goal is to go into politics so he can help the homeless community and people fighting addictions and mental illnesses. It's been a year of major life changes for the couple, but they're no longer looking back at the life they once had. This chapter isn't about drugs or recovery. It's about achieving the goals they had almost forgotten. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week, we're hearing from Bulo Croker from Anchorage.
I came up here the year before last because I have a son who served in the U.S. Army here on Jay Bear, and that's how I came here to Alaska. I came here, it was winter, we just passed winter, And it was still cool, and I really like the cold weather. They're coming from the sunny place of Fiji, which is always warm. I appreciate the cold. The houses itself are quite expensive, the rent. But the people, they are quite friendly. And they are quite helpful. I thought it would be one of the prestigious states, but it's not. I came here like before the 2 years, I've seen a lot of development. There's a lot of developing going on, and I've seen that increase in traffic on the road, which states there's a lot of people moving up here. And also PFD is one of the things that's attracting a lot of people. I myself wished I could go back because I have 10 kids. I would have moved up here those years if it was cheaper for me to travel. The thing that I can say about Alaska, Alaska has a lot to give to the people who are wanting to move up here to Alaska. It can provide you a lot of good jobs and pay, for instance, it starts with a good rate, like $10 up. And I would like to ask a lot of people, trade people out there, that Alaska needs you. And you are welcome to come up here and make it your home. But it's hard for you to sweat, so you better watch what you eat.
Bulo Croker lives in Mountain View. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Ann Hillman, Wesley Early, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories around the state. I'm Quentin Chandler.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing on the Iditarod Trail, Daisha Eaton in Homer, Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Brielle Schaefer in Sitka, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and Emily Files in Haines. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Rachel Waldholtz. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive educational adventure designed to support your personal and professional goals. Through generous APU scholarship packages and the new APU Promise Tuition Grant Program, APU is a sound educational investment in your future. Apply today at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.